If you're rocking to get up and it's not a rocking chair, it's time for the Joint Relief Institute. Fast relief, covered by Medicare. 708-888-0000, as in zero pain.
WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch on a lovely Saturday afternoon. I hope you are outside and enjoying the warm, beautiful sunshine because you know what? That's how we do in this town, right? We soak it in while we have it. Thanks for being with us today. We've got a lot of stuff to talk about. We're going to be talking about some numbers connected to Mother's Day and look at exactly how much do we spend on our moms? Is it enough? Should we be spending more? And what are we spending it on and where? We're going to be looking at that. We're also going to be talking about some LinkedIn communication tips that you're really going to want to stick around for. And we're going to take a different look and a different approach at building a resume. We're going to build a resume of failure, not of wins. We're going to be talking about that a little bit later. But right now, we have a very special guest in the studio. Tom Rosenfeld is the founder of Earth First Farms, and he's also the owner of Heartland Cafe here in Chicago. If you know that place, you love that place. It's a great, great place up on the far north side. But there's a really, really interesting competition happening right now, and that is the Food to Market Challenge. It's a collaboration between the Chicago Community Trust and Kinship Foundation. And what is at stake is $500,000. It is this winner-takes-all competition, and it challenges teams to improve the supply of local and sustainable food here in the Chicago area. And so all these teams are competing for this big, big pile of cash. And so here, that brings us back to Tom. So welcome to the show, Tom. Tell us about what your team is doing to prepare for this competition.
Well, it's an interesting competition, and thanks for having me on your show. The competition itself involves putting together teams. We have a team of 15 different businesses, organizations, farmers, and we're putting together a program to address the goals of this thing. We submit an application on Tuesday, then something magic happens. There's 15 or 12 judges. Then we get notified, hopefully, in about a month if we make it to the down select. If we get to that far, then we get to put together a video and then have a Shark Tank-like shoot 'em out live theater competition in October.
Nice. Where will that be? Do you know?
It's, you know what? I'm not even focused on that. It's right in a theater here in
One
Chicago.
One thing at a time, right?
Exactly. Let's get to
the first round, and then we will talk about strategy for the second round. And what's interesting about this competition is that the amount that is at stake, that $500,000, is a number that you had identified in your business almost to the T for what you needed to kind of bring up the farms to the next goals and do some interesting things with the work you're doing there.
Yeah, it was kind of amazing in that sense. The challenges with local food is typically on a small scale. You have a small farm, you have maybe 10 acres, 15 acres, and you're growing a small amount of food. When they came out with this grant, we had already been working on a program to develop a local organic label, which we stopped because we figured, well, this will cost $500,000 bucks, and who's got $500,000? And then this grant came out. They have $500,000 bucks. The interesting thing here is most of the grants that you see are usually reimbursements, cost share, something like this through the USDA agriculture.
Like a subsidy of some kind, yeah.
Exactly. This one really has a potential to move the needle on local sustainable food by just having it winner take all. You have to have a big enough idea to spend $500,000.
Yeah. And so what all does your idea, let's think positively and say you make it to the Shark Tank part, what is the elevator pitch for the big idea of what you're going to do with this $500,000?
Well, we have to be careful with the elevator pitch because the applications aren't due until Tuesday.
Aha. So someone can take your idea. Okay, fair enough. So this big, awesome idea that you have that we will not mention, whatever it is, because we don't want to break it down too much and give someone a competitive advantage against you, certainly. But certainly good luck with it. And it will be really exciting to see all these different teams doing all these different things. And you're up against some really big names. You're up against the Chicago Botanic Garden, McCormick Place, some restaurants all part of like WIC and things like that. You're up against some very, very big things. So do you have a strategy necessarily for, attacking these, not attacking, that's a harsh word for farming, but, for addressing kind of these really big, big kind of monolith organizations?
We do. I mean, this challenge grant is all about increasing supply, and supply happens on the farm. We are a farmer-based, farmer-led idea that is coming from the farms and bringing food into the city. Most of our competitors are city-based organizations, not-for-profits, distributors, and they're really focused on the supply and the supply chain. Ours is more of a focus of getting farmers to stay on the farm, grow more food, and bring more food into the city, and so that's our idea.
Well, you know what I think is really interesting? I've been reading a lot about this with in that conversation with local and organic produce, is it seems like there was a shift when factory farming really took hold, where it became financially not really plausible for a farmer to grow a wide array of foods. There's a chef I read about in, I think somewhere in northern Georgia, somewhere in there, that got a hold of a recipe book and realized, from like a great grandmother or something, and realized half of this produce isn't even available anymore commercially. And so he set about to recreate this and find all these heirloom seeds and kind of bring it all back. Do you think that movement is still very much alive? Is that a big component of organic farming, of bringing out, you know, not just a type of strawberry, but say 16 kinds of strawberries? Is that diversity of type a really big component of organic farming?
Absolutely. It's all about the flavor of the food you're eating. You just mentioned 16 types of strawberries. Not a lot of people know that there's more than one kind of strawberry. And so what we do is we really focus on the taste, and we focus on the nutritive, like dense nutritional foods. And by growing that on our farm and bringing it to farm markets, which is mostly how organic, small organic farms interface with consumers, we get to extol the virtues of this kind of strawberry versus that kind. I mean, we're right around the corner. You mentioned strawberries. We're an organic grower of strawberries. Our early glows are blooming right now, and they're going to be ready in about 3 weeks. And we have a lot of fans who come to us and don't say, can I get a strawberry? But when are the early glows coming?
Oh, they want that one in particular.
They want that one in particular.
And so at your farm, you know, tell us a little bit about that, because at Earth First, is it like a you pick situation? Can people go and kind of pick their own part of things? Or do you rely really on that farmer's market as the main touch point for consumers?
See, this is the challenge of organic farming on a small scale. We do everything. We have a U-Pick, and the U-Pick is really more focused on our apples. We have about 30 acres of certified organic apples, and we do a U-Pick, and that's great. But that's not enough to sustain the farm. We run an apple CSA. We do multiple farmer markets. And then at the Heartland Cafe, we have a market that we sell all of our produce at. And still, it's a challenge. So we're spending a lot of time selling, and we'd like to spend more time growing.
Yeah, and hopefully this grant will help you. So how can people support both your farm, Earth First Farms, and support your team in the competition?
Well, the farm is easy. Come on out to any farm market.
Or buy
look
food.
Us up, look us up online and buy and pay attention to the food you're buying. If you buy from us, that's great. But any organic farm, certified organic growers in the area, they need your support. And so by asking questions when you're at a farm market, and understanding what it is that you're actually buying. Not every farmer at a farm market is organic. Many of them are great growers, but if you're looking for organic food, ask those questions. As far as supporting us, that's a good question.
We'll wait till the Shark Tank part,
right?
Wait
till the Shark Tank and come out and give us support.
Cheer loudly. Great.
Yeah, support your farmers.
So where can people find out about Earth First Farms online?
Earthfirstfarms.com.
Easy enough. All right. Thank you so much to our new favorite farmer, Tom Rosenfeld, for being here. And we wish you well in the competition. We'll be cheering for you big time. And we hope you get that $500,000 to all the cool organic farming stuff that you want to do. All right, my friends, we got to take a little break here on the Business Lunch. We'll be back in just a bit. And we're going to be taking a look at some of the numbers around retail and Mother's Day outings. We're going to be checking that out here in just a bit on 720 WGN. WGN. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm Amy Guth. Thanks for being with us on this lovely, lovely Saturday. I hope you are enjoying the weather while we have it. It's warm and sunny. Not as much as yesterday, but still good enough. We'll take it, right? We will take it. A little bit later in the show, we're going to be talking with Tim Denning from Addicted to Success. He's joining us from Melbourne, Australia today. And we're going to be talking about some LinkedIn tips. And then after that, we're going to be talking about making a resume that is the opposite of what we think of when we make a resume. We usually think of our wins. This one is all about the benefits of making a resume of fails. We're going to be talking about a couple of very accomplished people that have done just that. But you know what? Before we get into that, I want to talk a little bit about Mother's Day, because that is tomorrow already. Oh my gosh, I feel like Mother's Day is the point where you always go, oh my gosh, the year's almost over, right? It's like, oh my gosh, it's the halfway point. Because to me, 4th of July is really, really the, okay, summer's almost done, right? So, but I feel like when Mother's Day arrives, it's, you know, it's summer officially, it's on, right? So I want to take a look at some of the numbers around Mother's Day, because there are plenty of people that I saw out here on Michigan Avenue that with this look of panic that I recognize only from Valentine's Day and Mother's Day, because it is the like, oh, I got to get some stuff. There's some obligation attached to this, which that's a whole other show. I don't like the obligation holidays because people just sort of blindly do things. However, we pulled some numbers together for Mother's Day that's really interesting. Only out of the last, you know, ever, really, 2015 and 2016 are the years, because we're on track to do this again, as we did last year, to exceed $20 billion in retail sales for Mother's Day, which is crazy high. But you know, you gotta take care of mom. So $21.2 billion was spent total, not just in retail, but also in outings, you know, going out to lunch or brunch or whatever, things like that. So any kind of special day stuff for mom. The grand total was $21.2 billion,
and it's still not enough.
And it's still not.
It could never be enough.
Can't make her happy. Mother's Day. I did not expect this, but Mother's Day does outpace Valentine's Day in spending. I would not have guessed that at all, because it seems like there's so much obligation around Valentine's Day. People feel so obligated to do the whole, you know, like Walgreens turns pink and red, right, for 2 months before Valentine's Day. It seems like there's such a retail push, and then there's long lines at restaurants, and people are like, ugh.
Yeah. If you'd asked me, I would not have guessed that. But when you think about it, I don't know. I guess it makes sense. I don't know.
It's probably a safer bet to spend on your mom than a date.
Right.
Your mom's like, going to be your mom. The date might not
work.
You're
probably not going to break up with your mom.
But if you do, that's a whole other story. But, you know, interestingly, there was some data looking at where we spend. It's not just moms and stepmoms, although 63% of that number, 63% of it was for stuff for moms and stepmoms. 23%, that's a big jump. 23% is for the wife or the baby mama. Then 10% of that is for a daughter. Generally, though, it looks like that is only for her, like the first Mother's Day is when you would recognize your daughter's first Mother's Day.
Okay. So like you have a daughter and she just had her baby.
Right.
In the past year.
Yeah.
So you do that one Mother's Day, but then...
Like, it's your first Mother's Day. Here's some flowers or whatever.
Interesting. Right. That's the etiquette on that. Okay.
Yes. And then I usually do that for my friends. I'll recognize their first Mother's Day generally. Grandmothers are 7% of that, and godmothers are 2% of that, which is... I figured the godmothers would be up there a little bit higher, but... maybe not. And then it breaks down by stuff. And there's one number on here that I thought was a little bit weird. So flowers, that is over $2 billion. That is a ton of money. Gift cards seems like a weird thing to give your mom. Like, here, mom, here's a Best Buy gift card or yeah. That's a perfectly fine gift. But for your mom, that seems
better than nothing, I guess. But yeah, it's a little impersonal, maybe.
It's a little impersonal. Jewelry and special outings were each over $4 billion of that.
Okay.
So I can say, I think there's a lot of like Mother's Day jewelry that's advertised, the, you know, the little bracelets with the special beads on them, the charm things, stuff like that. It used to be, I feel like in the 70s and 80s, it was all about that mother's ring that had the birthstone of all your kids in it. I feel like everybody was all into that thing. But here's the one that I thought was a little bit weird. Just under $2 billion of that number is consumer electronics, which seems like a kind of cool mom gift.
Yeah.
I'm guessing a lot of that is GPS.
You think so?
I don't know.
Interesting. Well, I'm thinking my mom would like a Roku, kind of like computer TV connector or something
sure.
like that.
That could be.
Yeah.
That could be.
Can't go wrong.
Also, it looks like people who do their shopping online tend to spend 38% more than people that do it in a brick and mortar establishment.
Mm-hmm.
And it breaks it down by group of shopper. And it seems as if the group that spends the least on their mom, and this makes perfect sense, people over 55, because you probably, not as many people have their moms around still, so that makes perfect sense. The group that spends absolutely the most is 25 to 34-year-olds spend on average $244 on their moms for Mother's Day. And the average, the national average is $173, which is up. In 2003, it was $97.
That's a good average. How much of that money is being spent on 3D replicas of people that don't live near their parents? I just saw this New York Times story about people buying 3D replicas of themselves to send to their mom.
My mom would hate that with a fire of a thousand suns.
They're bringing up the average, though, because each one costs $30,000.
And how, I mean, I saw the story, but I didn't see the picture. I didn't see any pictures attached to it. Is it a realistic looking replica?
It's very creepy. I mean, I don't know how it couldn't be. We're still not there. I'm still not like in the future enough to think that this is an acceptable thing to do, but.
Indeed. It's a company in Alabama.
Yeah. I don't know how many people are actually making these purchases, but they are out there. This is real.
I do not ever question the lengths people will go to do completely weird things. So this company in Alabama, they're making, as he said, actual life-size replicas of any human being. It's a 3D printing situation, and it is $30,000. I think my mom would say, you are an idiot for $30,000. That could have gotten you a lot of plane tickets to come see me.
Yeah.
That's what she would have said to me. She would say, you're an
idiot.
A
certain kind of mom out there maybe is interested in the 3D replica market.
I would love to hear from that mom if you are interested in a 3D replica of your kid. That seems pretty weird to me, but hey, you never know. Anyway, my friends, we got to take a little break and get you to news with our good friend Bob Kessler. When we come back, we're going to be talking about some LinkedIn communication tips that I super love because it's all about being more human and less in that social media buzzwordy thing that we're always railing against on this show. We're going to be talking about that right after the news here in just a bit on 720 WGN. WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch on this lovely Saturday afternoon. Thank you all for listening and spending time with us today. So here in a bit, we're going to be checking in Melbourne, Australia. We're going to be talking with the founder of Addicted to Success about some LinkedIn tips, because that is so super important when the way we use social media platforms, it really varies by platform. And sometimes I think LinkedIn is a weird platform because it's, I think a lot of people kind of misuse it, right? I think some people kind of treat it like Facebook. I've even seen a couple of people sort of treating it like a dating app or something, right? I think people do a lot of different things with LinkedIn. And so when we get everything set up and everything's happening in Australia, we're going to be talking with someone who wrote about some really great tips about the way you use LinkedIn, which I think is really good because I think it is a breeding ground for and Bob and Griffin, you tell me if you agree. I think it's kind of a breeding ground for that super corporate buzzword kind of way, the social media guru thing. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I think it probably is. I have a LinkedIn account, but I don't really use it.
I never check in. And sometimes I go to my LinkedIn messages and I see that someone has sent me an opportunity or a speaking opportunity. And it was like 4 months ago. I mean, I'm active on Facebook and Twitter, Instagram, newly Snapchat. But I LinkedIn is, it doesn't feel active to me. I mean, it feels like a place where you check in and stay, you kind of nurture your connections, but it's not a place where you're actively engaging people, I think. But I could be wrong. I think some people use it in different ways. And I do like a lot. I really like when you are attempting to connect with someone on LinkedIn, it'll say, do you know this person? How do you know this person? You know, it wants you to say, oh, we did business at this place. We were a colleague here, or this is a personal friend and here's his or her email or something like that. I like that because I feel like on Facebook, it's just kind of everybody.
Yeah, but LinkedIn, I heard you can pay extra and you can see who has been creeping on you.
You can, which is the best. There is there's certain trainings you can take and they'll give you that privilege for a year without paying. So they do a series of webinars. They do one for journalists that I did that was really, really great and really useful. It was all about using LinkedIn to source, to find sources when you're reporting a story. But they gave, as part of that, you got a year of premium LinkedIn, and it was fascinating to see exactly that. You see who's creeping on you.
Do you like knowing that, or would you? I would actually prefer sort of not to know.
I preferred to not know because then it was in my head. And then next time I saw that person, I was like, why did you go to my LinkedIn 7 times this week?
In 3 hours.
What are you doing? what's happening right now. But I think that would be really interesting to see on, you know, on Facebook or Instagram or something. I think that kind of, I think that would be even more disturbing, though, to tell you the truth.
I think it would be too. Yeah. Well, Facebook doesn't, they don't do that. It's not possible to do that. For a while, I think there were scams running saying you can set up your account to do that on Facebook. But I think they were just that. They were scams.
They were. Yeah, definitely. I think it'd be really interesting on Instagram.
Yeah.
Super interesting.
But Instagram's just all about the pictures.
Yeah, it's all about the visual.
I have 6 whole pictures on my Instagram account.
Well, we got to up your Instagram game.
Well, I did it. You know, it's funny. I got back into shooting on film photography. And I've always had an interest in photography and I do it. And so I got out this old film camera and took some shots and developed them in the darkroom. Then I was like, well, I got to post these. I'll post them on, Instagram. That's all my Instagram account is now. So it's only a month old.
Right.
Yeah.
There is an interesting site called 500px, and I think it's kind of tailor-built for people that use it like you, that like very, you know, a photographer with really kind of that, you know, that gets that kind of very professional look in their work, but you can only upload one photo a day.
That's great.
So you have to kind
of, I love that.
Yeah, you have to kind of pick your best. I think there's a way you can license it even, because I think people use it for stock photography, so I think there's some money to be made there.
Oh,
but
now
you know,
I'm interested.
I know, but I love the idea that you have to just pick your best. You can't just like dump a bunch of photos in there. All right, my friends. We are going to turn our attention to our friend Tim Denning. Hi, Tim. He is the founder of Addicted to Success, a blog I have read for a very, very long time. So it's a pleasure to meet you, Tim. Hello, and good afternoon in Australia.
Hi, Amy. How are you going?
Great, great. Thanks for joining us today. Well, you know, I read with great, great interest the piece on Addicted to Success about the LinkedIn guru, because I think that is, you know, something I think gets a lot of eye rolls from a lot of us, you know, the like, oh, here's another person just saying a lot of buzzwords. But I was really excited to see this headline, and that is why you should ignore LinkedIn gurus and communicate like a human again, which I say amen to that. And there's some really great tips in this story. And so everybody should go to addictedtosuccess.com. That is the number 2, not T-O, and check this out. But, you know, one of those in there, well, there's a lot of great tips, but I think the second one is really interesting, and that is says, ignore anyone who says personal brand. Let's start with that. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so, Amy, we get a lot of LinkedIn trainers come into the company that I work in, and we have about 40,000 employees, and what they keep telling us is that we need to pump up our personal brands. And I personally think that personal brand is a very selfish way to look at LinkedIn. And the success that I've had on there is that when you're giving value and you're sharing things that people want to see, that's when you have the best benefit on there. If you're just talking about yourself and your company and all you do is post things that your company has done, that's very boring and it's very saturated. And so I'm really against the whole personal brand thing. And what was interesting is when I actually wrote that article, LinkedIn contacted me and the two things they said was that personal brands and what was the other one I said? Personal brands, I can't remember what the other one was, but they didn't necessarily agree with that point, but they really valued the article. So yeah, I just think that not being selfish on LinkedIn is the key to the whole platform.
Yeah, which really comes through in this piece that you wrote, because you also mentioned helping people out and not making it about you, points 5 and 7, which I think are really, really great. And something I've said a long time about social media, that if you just get up there and pontificate and talk about, you know, pimp your own stuff, then it's not going to be as interesting. And people aren't going to connect with you, because they're just going to think, gosh, what a shill. I don't want to connect with this person. But I think when you make the content, you know, useful, when you're sending things that's maybe not from you, but that's of interest to your readers or your network, that's when I think people are more apt to connect with you.
Yeah, correct. And I think what sells on LinkedIn really well is emotion. So one thing I've spent a lot of time doing is I've actually looked at what the top posts are, what are the ones that get thousands of shares. And if you look at every single one, there's a strong attachment to emotion. So, you know, I posted something the other day where it was a photo of me at the Great Wall of China. But I linked it back to how that experience of climbing the Great Wall of China has helped me in business. So if you're just posting personal photos, it becomes like Facebook and it doesn't make sense. But when those personal photos are linked back to what you do in business or day to day, that's what really hits home on LinkedIn, and that's how you be successful on there.
Which is a really, really interesting point, because I think people do not think about it that way. I think a lot of people feel compelled to be very buttoned up on LinkedIn and very just all business, and tend to put their more emotional things on Facebook. But I think that is a really excellent tip of, you know, relating it back to the work that you're doing, relating it back to, you know, making it useful, something like that, which I think is something you do really well in addictedtosuccess.com, just because it's there, as you say, there's things like, there's this travel thing, but here's, I learned this from the Great Wall that I have applied to my business. You know, there was an op-ed I read recently that was all about things that we can learn, business leaders can learn from the Flint water crisis. And I think it's that same kind of thing where we take something either personal or in the news, or something that will be kind of a hook and compelling, and then expand that out to have that business case, or to be useful, or to serve the people that around us.
Yeah, the number one thing that works really well on LinkedIn is stories. In fact, that works on any social media platform. So if you're telling a compelling story, people want to read that. What they don't want to see is, you know, sales copy and marketing and that stuff. It's just saturated all of the social media platforms. That's been done before. So if that's your angle, you're not really going to be successful on there. And when I've sort of had a lot of this training internally at the company that I work at, that's been a lot of the push, is push your own brand and push the company. And I've just noticed that the people that do that, they get no likes, no comments, no shares. No one's interested in what they're doing. And they're beating their head against the wall, wondering why it's not working. And so I'm trying to teach to do the exact opposite and actually be like a human on LinkedIn rather than just, you know, someone that works for a company.
I think that's really, really excellent advice, because, again, so many times on this show, I'm always railing on people that are so immersed in buzzwords and calling themselves a guru and, you know, doing all these things. I was like, can't we just be human? Can't we just connect with each other? Which is another point in this piece that you wrote that says it's okay to add people that you haven't met, which, you know, I kind of like that there's a little bit of a stopgap there. You know, just a bit ago, we were just talking about that on the show, that there's a little bit of a stopgap, that you can't just add a total stranger. Or you have to be introduced or have a connection there, in a mutual connection somehow, or know their email, or have worked together somewhere, something like that. So you have to have that through line. But I think I think people have really strong opinions about adding people they don't know on LinkedIn and Facebook, for sure.
Yeah, I'm the opposite of that. I also think that's a myth. And that was actually the second point that LinkedIn said to me that they don't necessarily agree with. But I've found it very valuable if you've got a very strong profile and you're very legitimate on LinkedIn, it's perfectly fine to add people that you don't know, as long as there's some sort of commonality, like you work in the same industry or there's some value that you can bring to what they do. And so when you connect with them, if the message that you send to them is compelling when you do that connection, there's absolutely nothing wrong with it. And I've had some amazing success stories where I've just added, you know, like CEOs of major technology companies over there in the US, because I'm here in Melbourne, Australia. And, you know, they've connected with me and I've ended up doing business with them, all from just randomly adding them. So there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. It's a myth. You don't need to know people. As long as you're not spammy in your approach, there's no problem with that at all.
Yeah, I think that's good advice. I mean, personally, I've used it to find experts for, you know, when I need a radio guest. If there's a, you know, something in the news that happens, I often look at LinkedIn and say, well, who is an expert in this? Who am I connected to, or who are my people connected to? So I agree with that point a lot. I think that's a very, very good one. All right, everybody, head to addictedtosuccess.com. That is addicted, the number two, not T-O, addictedtosuccess.com. Tim Denning is the guy, the founder, that makes all this great content. It is a site that I have read and enjoyed for a very, very long time. Tim, it is a pleasure to chat with you. Enjoy the rest of your afternoon in Australia, and we will chat with you again soon. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Amy.
All right. Okay, my friends, we're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we are going to be talking about making a resume to highlight your failures, not your wins, your failures. We're going to be talking about why that matters here in just a bit on 720 WGN. WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. I hope you're enjoying the beautiful, beautiful day outside and getting out in that sunshine a little bit. My friends, you know, we think a lot about our resumes. We think about padding them. We tisk-tisk people for perhaps padding them a little too much, perhaps fabricating a little something on there. But we never talk about what it means to make a fail resume of the things we did not do, the things that did not work out for us, the things maybe we wanted so badly, but that it didn't work out. So there is a two-time PhD named Johann Haushofer. He went to Oxford, and he from, Harvard and University of Zurich, and he has all this wonderful education. He's very, very accomplished. His academic CV is 7 pages long. So here's a very, very accomplished person. But just recently, he kind of blew up the Twittersphere a little bit because he tweeted this. He made a CV of failures, essentially. It was the things that didn't work out. Degree programs he didn't get into, academic positions and fellowships he did not get, and rejections from academic journals. Basically, he just like piled up all the stuff that did not work out for him the way that he wanted it to, and he made a CV of fails. Now, he says this is not his own idea. There was, in fact, someone else, Melanie Steffen, who is a postdoc at Caltech. She originally did this, and he got the idea there. Again, a person of tremendous achievement, but had this epiphany that for every hour, that they had spent working on something that succeeded wildly, that created these, 7-page-long academic CVs, they're probably 6 hours working on something that failed miserably. So there is a really interesting piece up at the Harvard Business Review written by Bill Taylor, who is the co-founder of Fast Company, who joins us right now on the show. Hi, Bill. Bill, you there?
I'm there, Amy. How are you?
Hi, how are you? Welcome to the program. Glad you could join us today. So talk about this failure resume and what it can help us learn about ourselves, because I read with great interest your piece at harvardbusinessreview.org about it being not just a kind of fun and flip, silly tool, but in fact an exercise that's really rather insightful.
Sure. Well, I think the idea's been around for a while, but really more just as an idea. In other words, if you want to get comfortable taking bigger risks, or if you want to understand that success really isn't a straight line, you should kind of think in your head of your resume of failure. Now, lo and behold, pretty accomplished people are actually literally creating these documents and then putting them up for others to see. And I think they have a couple of big positives. First of all, they teach the person who's writing it to be a bit more resilient, maybe also to be a bit more humble, but to understand, as the young postdoc woman from Caltech said, I mean, we all have to recognize that we spend most of our time working on things that don't work out, so let's not be surprised when a project doesn't go to completion, or we apply for a job we don't get, or, we write a paper that doesn't get published, and hopefully that just all makes us stronger. But now, to be honest, sharing them with the world is kind of an interesting way to maybe get attention for yourself and also to get attention for your successes, because after all, you have to be a pretty confident person with a lot of success to also be willing to share your failure. So in an odd little twist, being more open about your failures may also bring more attention to your successes.
Indeed. I think that's a really interesting idea. The one that comes to mind, I feel like I always see this, posted in kind of inspirational quotes and inspirational posters. I see it on Pinterest and LinkedIn. Is the one about Abe Lincoln, right? It kind of breaks down by age, 30, he had a nervous breakdown. By age 40, he did this. And it kind of lists all these fails when we think of him as being such a wildly successful human being that so contributed to the history of our nation. And I think that's a really interesting one, too. But it's kind of painting that same idea that, Abe Lincoln did a lot of wonderful stuff, but yet he had plenty of, it wasn't all easy for him. It wasn't all without struggle. He struggled too. He had numerous fails before he got his successes, and that's a kind of an interesting point. I do think it is interesting, as you say, how people are then sharing it. So I admit, I read your story, and then I sat down to do one of my own, and I decided I was going to make my own failure resume. And it was, I feel like I'm pretty tough on myself for, meeting my deadlines and doing, hitting my goals and things like that, but found it pretty difficult to sit down and really write that. But then once I did it, I don't know that I wanted to share it with anybody. I sure wasn't going to tweet it.
And you certainly don't need to have it have an effect. I mean, I must say, at the very least, it's an interesting exercise in self-reflection, because I think as we move on in life and we enjoy our share of successes, it's easy to forget, repress, set aside all the struggles we had, and just bringing those back up, I do think creates just more resilience going forward. And so it's a very useful exercise for all of us just to really relearn our own journey and prepare for the next inevitable failure. And then I think also doing it and publishing it and writing it up with a sense of humor, with a sense of fun, makes it easier to share. My favorite part of the Princeton professor's failure resume, he quickly had to update it with what he called his meta failure, which is this darn CV of failure has received way more attention than any of my academic work ever has, which is a funny little twist. And again, a sense of humor counts for a lot in terms of being willing to share your failures with the rest of the world.
Right. It really does. I saw a few people tweeting about this after Professor Haushofer initially put his out there, and all of Twitter was going so crazy about it. I saw someone tweeting about it with kind of a sudden stark insight, you know, over a series of five or six tweets, this person went, oh my gosh, I sat down, I did this same thing, and I just realized the four biggest things that are such sticking points to me that I feel like were just colossal failures all had this common thread, and I realized I know how to do this now. So to him, it was this great benefit. So I think there is great insight, not only, as you mentioned, about resilience, but I think sometimes you could have an epiphany of, oh my gosh, I made this misstep every time, or I did this thing every time. But I absolutely agree that having a sense of humor about it is very funny. And if you haven't read this, this CV of failures, it's very, very funny. But everybody, head to HarvardBusinessReview.org and read this story written by Bill Taylor. It's Write a Failure Resume to Learn What Makes You Succeed. It links to the originals. It links to lots of great, great things in there. So I encourage you to go check that out. Bill Taylor, thanks so much for joining us today on the program.
Thanks, Amy. I hope this conversation wasn't a failure. I don't want to put it on my failure resume.
Not at all. It's going to go on your regular resume, not the failure one. Thanks for being
with
us.
Thanks so much, Amy.
Have a great day. All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break and get you to news and then turn you over to King John. I'll be back here next week. So we'll be back in just a second on 720 WGN.